Tell her to come and help me. From May 1999, the Scottish Refugee Council coordinated the Kosovo Protection Programme, which was the largest programme to date then, and a lot more has happened since. But in 1999, their action followed an agreement between the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, and the European governments in order to provide temporary accommodation and shelter and protection for Kosovans who had fled ethnic cleansing. I'm sure you'll remember this. The Refugee Council worked with Glasgow City Council, Renfrewshire Council and East Lothian Council to provide accommodation and various kind of support services. Buildings were furnished and staffed in a matter of weeks to accommodate these poor folk. In 2000, the focus changed from resettlement to helping people return safely or to make claims for asylum. And throughout that project, which lasted these years, the council worked with nearly 400 refugees. This work gained huge media interest and did a lot for support to the Refugee Council. The first of two planes carrying about 145 refugees touched down at Prestwick Airport on Sunday, May the 9th, 1999. And one of our presbytery elders from Kincardine and Deeside had been on the reception group at Prestwick. I can't remember whether this was because of the Guild or the Refugee Council or other work that she did. She was one of these busy ladies. She did a lot of things. But she was asked to come and speak to us at the following presbytery about her experience. And listening to her was very interesting. She described the very sad conditions of people, some of whom had had to flee with only the clothes on their backs. Some of them had all they had with them in a polythene bag, a shopping bag. Others had had to leave behind family and friends, and the courier who was with them from the Refugee Council told of how they'd taken off their coats and passed them back to their relative before they got on the bus to help see them through the year ahead. Things were as bad as that. Some of these people hadn't eaten properly for days, and they were very, very tired. Medical examinations proved that they were reasonably healthy. Not many of them needed serious treatment. It was only the old and the seriously infirm who were bad. But the support teams were standing by after the people had gone through the necessary paperwork and the medical clearance that they needed. And there they were with food, with tea and sympathy. Our elder, like the others round about her, were surprised, nay baffled, when the Catholic refugees were diverted from the catering tables and taken off to the nearest makeshift sanctuary, which was in a hall at the airport. What she said was, the Catholics were all taken off somewhere else first, and they were away for ages. The young priest who was sitting beside me, who was the Catholic Church representative to the presbytery, said to me under his breath, they were going to receive the comfort of the Holy Sacrament. Of course. Now that seems to me to be the embodiment of the Martha and Mary situation. A situation of different priorities with respect to the needs of the body or the soul. The Presbyterian viewpoint didn't comprehend the Roman one. And it said, I'm sure, food first. Does this mean, I wonder, that our church maybe projects too much of a Martha role for itself in modern times? This modern times is a problem because as you go about, you find people are interested in cultivating spirituality, but they're also interested in food. There's certainly a classical interpretation of this story of Martha and Mary. Two aspects of service are presented here. One of busy and necessary work, which copes with life's ever-present problems, which faces reality. And the other is of communion with God, of contemplation and withdrawal from the everyday, avoiding the preoccupations of worldliness. And for centuries, the Roman Catholic Church has balanced the two, where there were orders of religious monks and nuns, some of whom spent their time entirely in praise, worship, and contemplation, and others who got their sleeves rolled up and their skirts rolled up, goodness knows as well. They certainly had skirts, that's what I remember about the nuns of St. Vincent de Paul that I saw at home, helping the poor. And that was what they did. So there were both Martha's and Mary's. And there was a choice. Some people claim, even psychologists, that the world is made up of Martha and Mary people of both sexes. Some are thinkers and some are doers. Mary is seen either as the dreamy, lazy bones who was too heavenly minded to be of any earthly use, or as the earnest disciple intent on spending every possible moment with the Lord. Martha is then held up as the one who gets on and does things, or as the harassed and misguided hostess whose devotion to Jesus was actually keeping her away from him. Well, that's sisters for you. See, if both sisters had worked together, they could have shared the time with Jesus. Couldn't Mary have seen that her sister needed a hand? And are there, of course, two kinds of welcome? The kind of welcome that gives the guest attention and shows hospitality and gives some sustenance, and the other one that says, I'll come and sit beside you and talk with you. Or, listen. And some people really like a good listener. And I'm not one of them. You see what I'm doing through here? As with many episodes in the Bible, we can find a personal response. And I'm working out mine in explaining this story and adding to it. And I'm saying, are you a Martha or a Mary type? Because each of us will take the side of the sister that we might identify with. And artists who depict the scene have certainly done this. I can remember from my Sunday school days getting the wee leaflet with the colour picture on the front, and it shows Mary sitting at Jesus' feet with the light shining on her and looking quite holy, quite saintly, whereas in the background there's this kind of smoky dark kitchen with somebody toiling away miles away. And of course, that tells you all the artists know about kitchens. They know that's where the food comes from. And one of the best pictures, one of the pictures that I like, is this one of Vermeer. You won't be able to see it. You would if we had the projector. But I'll leave it down here so that you can see it. You can go through to the small hall and you can see it during coffee. And it shows Mary and Martha and Jesus. And Martha's bringing a plate with a loaf on it. So she's bringing the food in. And Jesus is looking at her and pointing at Mary. And we've a fair idea what he's saying. Now, of course, the picture that I've had onto the service sheet this morning is one of these South American black and white prints. And it shows the same, actually, the same picture as this Vermeer, which is from the 17th century. And the Jesus is got an open hand. And Martha has the accusing pointing finger, which you will see, and Mary's hands are folded in her lap. All these things are significant in the message of the picture and of the story. One of the interesting things that Moffat says in his translation of the 1930s Moffat's translation of the Bible was one of the early contemporary versions, and he said, in Jesus' words, Mary has chosen the best dish. Now, I think the Authorized Version says Mary has chosen that good portion. But it's as if he's talking about a menu because he knows that that will relate to Martha. It's almost a joke. Mary has chosen the best part. This is a sort of playful remark that somebody might make in a house where they were very welcome. And we know that Jesus was welcome in the house of Martha and Mary. He was almost a member of the family. We know he was there often. We're told that in the scripture. And we're told that the house is Martha's house. Now, that's another thing altogether. One interpretation of the name Martha is mistress of the house. And we know from other references in John's Gospel's account of the raising of Lazarus how close Jesus was to this family. I wonder how you would tell this story to a child. I think that's the best way of thinking about anything in the Bible that's difficult. How would you explain that? Would you keep an objective view about the sisters? Would you seek to influence the child's view? Would it depend on the age of the child? Think about that one. Let's think about Martha for a moment. There's no doubt that she made Jesus welcome in her home. There seems no doubt that she had many jobs to do. We don't actually know whether these were the normal tasks of the household, which she was being left to do alone, or whether she kept them to herself, or whether on this occasion she was doing special things in honour of the visitor. She did object to Mary's being absent from duty, and that was the way she saw it. And Jesus gently tells her, "Dinna fash yoursel." And if we follow Moffat's line about a menu, then we might think Jesus is saying, "All I wanted was a sandwich." The words of Jesus indicate that he is favouring whatever choice Mary has made, perhaps hinting to Martha that she should recognise Mary's choice a bit more carefully. Maybe the tasks that Martha had chosen were unnecessary in terms of making Jesus welcome. If somebody's a member of the family, then you quite often don't observe all the niceties in bringing them into the home. But maybe Martha was the sort of person who was always looking for something to do. The sort of person who expresses affection by doing rather than being still and just giving their company. Such folk often seem compulsive or obsessive. You know, the parent who finds it hard to stop being the mum or dad figure. The mum who comes down the front of the curtain, wipes her son's nose before he comes up and the bride comes in. Or the person who comes to the sick room and runs around changing the water, rearranging the flowers, plumping up the cushions, whether the patient wants it or not. There can be no doubt that these are gestures of somebody who means well and have the best intentions, but they're not the only way to show love and care, and that's what people need to be reminded about. People shouldn't undervalue themselves in this way. People shouldn't think that the only way they can feel wanted or appreciated or recognized is by being useful and not doing what the Quakers say, which is don't just do something, sit there. People should know that we value them for what they are, not just for what they do, and make sure that what they do isn't taken for granted, and that's our job. For all we know, Martha might be the one who is asked every day, "What's for supper?" Because it's left to her. But there again, I'm reinterpreting the story. The Peruvian theologian Gustavo Gutierrez doesn't just see Jesus' treatment of women as an important indicator for the oppressed of today's world, where there is still a great deal of inequality. In the case of the sisters at Bethany, he says, well, Mary is able to share in a role that was expected to be a male preserve in the realm of study and discussion of the law, because he's assuming that's what Jesus is talking to her about, the law, the word. But for Martha, he criticizes her. He says she remains a prisoner of what she considers to be her proper role as a woman and mistress of the house. Her condition as a woman does not limit her to those tasks of the household. Now, our Old Testament reading about the capable wife is that. I sometimes read extracts from that in the New Living Translation at funeral services. It expresses for many people what they feel about their mother, about how she says they're all warm in winter and they're fed and they're looked after, and she is strong and respected and not afraid of the future. She speaks with a gentle wisdom. She is always busy and looks after her family's needs. There we are. Charm is deceptive, this passage ends, and beauty disappears. But a woman who honors the Lord should be praised. Give her credit for all she does. She deserves the respect of everyone. Now, we've had a feminist and liberationist viewpoint on Martha. But Martha's vindication is in John's Gospel at the time of the raising of Lazarus. This is the bit that we don't usually hear when we hear the story of Martha and Mary. John 11. Martha said to Jesus, "If you had been here, Lord, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask him for." "Your brother will rise to life," Jesus said. "I know," she replied, "but he will rise to life on the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me will live even though they die. And all who live and believe in me will never die. Do you believe this?" "Yes, Lord," she answered. "I do believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who was to come into the world." Martha knows, perhaps even what Mary is still learning. Martha has the faith which says to Jesus, "I know, whatever you ask of God, God will grant you." Martha has a faith that we might envy. And the story of her and her sister and their brother reminds us that our lives are full of choices we can freely make. So when you hear the story again, or when you hear somebody talking about the Martha complex, which I think is described more often than the Mary one, then understand sympathetically what that situation might be. There were four elderly sisters who sat in the pew behind me in the church when I was a boy. There was a Martha and a Mary and a Janet, and I've forgotten the name of the other one because she was the youngest. So she was known as the youngest. Two of the others were married, but they were the Misses Edgar, and they all worked for the church. They made the tablet at Christmas. They made the cakes for the sale. They were always there to help and to work, and they worked together admirably. They were a very impressive bunch of old ladies, and they all deserved the tribute in Ecclesiastes. May God help us to decide for him and divide the use of our time wisely between working and waiting to receive the message of Christ, so we may learn how we can work like Martha, worship like Mary, and witness to the resurrection like Lazarus.